the more complex the scene usually there than the last one to get completed. And so as it goes on, and part of it is to sell the idea up front, and then you, by the time you kind of get into the main part of your campaign, you're starting to identify your characters, you're starting to identify some of the backstories of some of the characters and the relationships between them. And by the time the movie comes out, hopefully you've got a pretty good idea. For something like Cars, or even Pirates, they try to have something in that loop for everyone in the audience to get the widest possible breadth. So we try to do, I think on Cars we'll end up having, I think, three trailers and things that the Pirates.
Were there any unique challenges with Cars versus the previous Pixar films that you feel like you had to overcome just because of the fact that they're Cars?
You know, not really. I think the film is, I think it's pretty safe to say it's maybe the most beautiful animated movie ever. It is just spectacularly gorgeous. And I think we could tell from the very first moment that John Lasseter was talking about Cars, and this has been in his head for years. He comes from a car family. His dad ran a parts department for GM in Whittier, California, and John's always had a big love for cars and for animation, and I think this is this big opportunity to combine the two. And I think from the moment that we saw it, it's one that, you know, goes across basically every age from 8 to 98. To have something there for everybody, and couldn't be happier with it.
Would you say, let's say, 4 months from now, or after Pirates comes out around that time frame, given what you're releasing and given what all your competitors are releasing, that we will know for sure 4 months from now whether we have a problem in the industry or whether we had a bad year?
Yeah, this year ought to this ought to be a good year. Seems like a bell ringer, if you will. There's some, not just from ourselves, but also I think from the industry, there certainly looks like on paper to have some really, really terrific movies. And I think this will give us a good indication if it's just simply about products that people want to see, or if in fact there are behavioral issues and people are seeing or obtaining their content or their entertainment in some other way. I think you're probably right. I think this will be a good year to test that.
Fair way. I mean, and the two that you showed us are perfect examples of films that you really do need to see in a theater, as opposed to, I don't care how great, well, unless you have something like this in your house, but no one does or will. How do you communicate to the customers that these are films you go to a theater?
Yeah, I think having material like this, even the rough one that we showed you on Pirates, I think you got a good enough idea that we're showing a lot of different elements of the movie that we didn't show in the finished one that you saw. I think the vast scope of it, the fact that you've got to see it on a giant screen to take in all of that, you know, hopefully in our television commercials and our trailers just in the manner in which we talk about it, you know, hopefully we'll be able to convey the notion that, you know, you've got to see it in a big theater, you've got to see it on the big screen, you have to see it, I think, in all its glory, in order to really see it the way it should be seen.
It's a big event, no? Big event.
You have a different window for these movies than you usually do, or you're going to have the same window, just a different message, or how do you
convey that?
Right, you know, because again, we got that experience, but most people will see a trailer, you know, either as another trailer or if they're sick of movies, they'll see it on TV or something else, so they won't know what it is they're going to be missing if they don't see it in the theater. How do you
you say it over and over and over again through, you know, through publicity, through all of your press junkets, through everything, every communication that you send out, you say specifically that this is something that you need to see. We did something on cars as an example because we were fortunate enough to have it finished early enough. We screened it and showed up for all of our exhibitor customers, and domestically, and a huge contingency from international. And just to show, and we showed it in digital. We showed it on the biggest screens we could show it on. We did it twice. I think just getting that word out, even though there are customers and they're going to play it in their theaters, it starts that word of mouth. We have some press there. And, so hopefully they'll be able to help us convey that notion and that message to everyone. But that's a challenge. It's a challenge for every movie, trying to find those unique elements. What makes that movie special? Why do you need to go see that movie in a motion in a theater? And on the big screen. And both of these movies are, I think, great examples of ones that, you know, I think being with a lot of people and sharing in the excitement, and I think just enhances that whole experience. So hopefully we'll be able to do that.
How would you characterize your preference for that window, the box office window? How would you characterize your preference for that window? Because it's implying a preference for people choosing that window.
Oh, I think, you know, our movies are made for theaters. I mean, that's you know, these big movies that we make, that's where we like for people to see them. And I think, you know, that's the launching pad for everything else that follows. You know, you couldn't take something like Cars and have nearly the success if you went directly to video with it, and you'd lose all its impact. You know, they've spent almost 4 years, you know, creating this movie so that it could be seen on the screen, so that all of the characters and the vibrant color and all of that is a part of it. And you want that communal experience to share with others.
And we think, you know, after you see it in the theater, you'll want to go out and buy the DVD.
Or get in line and see it again. Correct.
And something like 2/3 of your division's profits are from video sale and rental. So how much of that 2/3 is from the newer films as opposed to the ones from the library?
A more and more significant amount is coming from newer films, as we've got these big event films as Dick just described. So, you know, obviously the video is a very important part of our business in terms of revenue and profit.
But to what extent do you care whether someone sees it in the theater or buys the DVD?
Well, we hope obviously that they do both. Obviously like two bites at the apple. And that's really our goal.
You make more money if they watch it on DVD, though.
Well, we don't really look at it sort of that way, because the DVD market is a huge market, but I think, as Dick was saying, it's set up largely, particularly for these kind of movies, by the theatrical market. So we launch it, people love it, they have to own it on DVD, so it's a critical part of our business.
I think the business changed in terms of what it was 5 years ago with the tentpole kind of films that we just saw, or is it pretty much the same as you negotiate on the distribution with some of your lesser titles in terms of how you use the tentpole films to gain distribution with the other films, or is it pretty much as it was 5 years ago?
You know, it's pretty similar. I think, you know, the importance of having the tentpole movies, I think it's always been important. I suppose you might say it's even more important today to have something that's special and unique. But I would say that just about all the movies. I think, at least if, to answer with a little more of the question that you asked a little bit earlier, I think the uniqueness of the movies it's very important to have something original, to have something that you can't experience, or it's a lesser experience to see at home. And I think, you know, if it's not just the size of the budget of making a movie, it's really what's that movie about? Is it about something, in fact, that the people will get out of their homes and want to go see? And is the experience going to be something that is going to be enjoyable and something that they want to repeat over and over again? But I think it's had an impact really on the movies that that we greenlight and the ones we say yes to. Are these movies special enough? Do they have an irresistibility that you have to go see these movies? And I think that criteria, that funnel, if you will, has become even smaller and tighter as time has gone by, so that the choices that we make, I think, are strange. We've got a kind of a little mantra. We want to make the right movie at the right price. It doesn't mean they all have to be giant movies, but if you're going to make a movie that's going to appeal to a smaller demographic, it's got to be at the right price, so that it's an economic box that we put our movies into, and hopefully that will lead to success at the end of the year.
If that's the case, given that the CGI movies out this year, 15 or so, and Pixar's only wanted to make one a year, how do you envision your CGI efforts going forward? Is it still going to be one a year, maybe two a year, and what's the saturation point for the total market? Is it 8, 10, 16?
And what is it?
Can you do more than 16 too many?
I think on an ongoing basis, we're hoping, depending on, release schedules and changes and all that kind of stuff, to have two a year. That's where we would like to be. Some years we won't make that. Some, we'll probably have one. Some years we may have three. But we will hopefully somewhere around there have two new original, one obviously coming from Pixar and one coming from feature animation. I think our feeling, I'm not sure what that point is. It becomes about the movie itself more than anything else, just like live action is. Cream will always rise to the top, and I think our feeling is that quality is what will sell and will always sell. It always has sold, and as long as we are at the top of the quality chain, I don't really know that it matters that much what everyone else is doing. I think a little bit you'll find right now is what happened. It happened right after The Lion King, when a lot of folks decided they wanted to get into animation in general, would be 2D animation. And, this is a business that takes a lot of fortitude. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of money. And it takes a lot of creative talent, both in drawing or so there'll be a kind of a shakeout over a period of time because they won't all be successful. But the ones that are of the highest quality and are the most entertaining will, and they'll continue to be. And, animation is a part of our heritage. It's a part of our legacy. It's what we do every single day. It's what we think of first every day. And so we're gonna be in it. And I think with Pixar, it'll simply just enhance us several fold over the course of the next few years, and be nothing but good things.
So do you think we've hit the high water mark in terms of the...
Probably, yeah. I would think it would be, certainly in the next year or two, we'll probably hit the high water mark, and then I'm sure there'll be a reduction.
What's a sustainable amount of Pixar movies per year?
What is it? I don't know what that number is. No, the marketplace always seems to expand. It does it at the summertime, does it at Christmas, to take in as many good movies as there are. I think if they're good, they'll succeed. If they're not good, they will fall behind.
That's beyond expectations of Ice Age bode well for Cars and that there's interest, or does it bode poorly in that maybe some viewers' appetite for CGI is now saturated?
Yeah, I don't know that you ever get, it's like good ice cream, you never get enough of it, you're finished in one day, you want it again the next. I think Cars will stand on its own as a movie and a piece of entertainment, just like live-action movies do. I don't think that someone that goes to see Mission Impossible is not going to go see The Da Vinci Code because, I got my live-action fix. I think you go to see good movies. And I think if we present Cars in the proper way, then I think, we will get our audience. If anything, though, I think it does I think it certainly helps the success, certainly of Ice Age, because it's just that many more people going to the movie theaters, getting back in the habit of going to the movie theaters. If they enjoyed what they saw, they're going to want to come back. And I think one of the great things about movies that appeal to that big of a demographic, and especially with kids, parents are always trying to search out great entertainment for their kids to go to and something that they can share in as well. And, you know, being a father of two daughters, I know, you know, I can't get enough good things to take them to. And I think, you know, I think it will fall in that. So I think it will have a, I don't think it will have a good effect or a bad effect. I think it's good that Ice Age did well because I think it just stirs up the marketplace and we needed something to stir it up a little bit and get people going back to the movies.
Personally, I would think, from my comment earlier about the two-thirds of profits coming from video movies, that given you've got a lot of video sales in the division, and you've got more animated films versus your competitors, revenues that you'd have higher-end margins versus the industry, instead you've got lower-end margins versus the industry. Can you explain that, and what's the... What's the plan for the future?
I would say that you know, it really comes down to the product. So the general ratios that you're referring to is really product driven. So it's really about timing. I think if you go, it depends what year you're looking at. If you go back a couple of years, I think that you'll see that the margins were higher because we had better, quite frankly, better movies running through our video group. So it really, you know, if you look at the margins as it relates to our business versus another studio's business, I think it really, a big component is what the movie is. So, you know, as Dick said, we're very excited about the movies we've got coming in the summer, and I think as you see those movies roll through our first quarter, you'll see the margins adjust as well.
So really structurally, that is correct, and if you deliver better quality content, then you would expect to be at the high end of the industry.
Well, I mean, I think that it, as Dick says, it's the right movie at the right price, and that's what we're ultimately focused on. The rest of it, clearly the distribution is critical, but if the movie isn't accepted as it rolls through the rest of the market, it's just not going to have the profit that a real strong performing movie would.
So how did the first Pirates do internationally?
Very strong. Very strong.
So best box?
It was actually slightly more. And I think we're expecting strong performance internationally as well. This one, probably even bigger.
And I don't know if folks are aware, but we have Pirates of the Caribbean 3 in the summer of 07. But on what do you expect?
I'm sorry. Quick question on our international scale. So, like, what part of the international region are you guys getting a lot of your movies? Sales from? Is there like a certain part of strategies growing than the other, or just depending on per movie?
It depends on, it totally depends on the movie. I don't think there is a region that we haven't done particularly well on, but depends on the movie. Unless, you know, it's like a Narnia, as an example, that just, you know, plays fantastically well in every territory. But it's so product related. There are movies that just will play in continental Europe better than Asia, and there are those that are playing in Asia better than continental. There's no real rhyme or reason.
Like in Asia or Japan, where children movie maybe tends to do a little bit better, or animated tends to be a little better than Asia?
You know, it's not really. The one, you know, good thing, and one where we feel very fortunate, that Disney, because it is such a strong brand name with families around the world, we tend to have a pretty good balance within all the territories. And there'll be some aberrations. The one that was just making headlines within Hong Kong with our movie Eight Below, that was just setting all sorts of records, and I wish I could tell you why. But if we hit some sort of an emotional chord or whatever in that particular marketplace, and it just has gone through the roof. It's going to be one of the most successful movies in the last, you know, several years, and it's
Is it with a theme park?
Well, I'd like to think so, at least some, to some degree, and certainly they were a great promotional partner, but really didn't have anything in the original movie. It was maybe it was the dogs, maybe it was the animals in Jeopardy.
98 degrees at Hong Kong and humans.
That very well. We don't discount anything. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I wish I knew all the answers to it.
Exactly.
But for whatever reason there were, we were very happy.
You know, around the world, apparently there's pretty negative American sentiment. Different people tell me different things. Some people tell me it's sort of pervasively anti-American. Other people tell me it's specific to the policies of an administration. Are you seeing anything? And maybe this is a more broad Disney question, because Disney is such an iconic U.S. symbol.
We really have not experienced it with our motion pictures or our DVDs or in the movies. We really haven't seen that part of it that I know what you're referring to and talking about. I think probably if it goes to more of the kinds of movies that we make or the themes and all that aren't really that political in nature and sort of hit on more human things and as opposed to things that are identified with culture or religion or politics or any of that. So yeah, it's a good answer I can give you on that one, but we haven't seen anything.
In terms of you greenlighting your films, how much are you factoring in your DVD sales and prospect listings for potential sales and DVDs, and are you looking out farther into the future for maybe DVD, HD, that sort of thing? How much are you factoring into that?
We factor all of that in looking at the movies that going forward. You know, I should have probably mentioned, I think we've said it on several occasions, we are changing and have changed the mix a lot in the kinds of movies that we are wanting to make. You're going to see over the course of the next several years, many more Disney movies. Now that we are in the process of having our animation put together and with both Pixar and Walt Disney Feature Animation. But in addition to that, I think if you look at our kind of releases going forward, you're going to see many more Disney movies. And because Disney movies, as I mentioned before, travel around the world so much better than others, it's the name on the door. And, you know, when we do a Pirates of the Caribbean or a Narnia or a National Treasure, when we do these kinds of movies, it just lifts the entire enterprise up. It helps what our parks are doing. It's creating new characters or new stories. Obviously, with the Pirates, it's an older attraction at the parks, but it gives us a whole new reason to reintroduce new characters to those attractions, to make them fresh again. It just sort of, from our consumer products to our music, to all of it just lifts everything up. So we're really, really going back even more to our roots than perhaps we had even in the past. It's not unusual. What we've done, you know, Walt Disney did it years ago with movies like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Didn't have a kid in it at all. It took, two of the hottest actors at the time. It was the number one film of the year. And it was a Disney film of 20,000 Leagues. And it's the same thing we're doing with Pirates. It's we're looking at the entire audience. It doesn't really matter, what age you are. You see that you're going to want to go see Pirates or National Treasure or any of that. So we're going to be making movies for the entire audience. And, they will still be very much Disney. They're not going to have language issues. We're not going to deal with sexual issues, but we're not afraid to take on the intensity or the fun or whatever. We can have a Captain Jack Sparrow in a PG-13 movie, but he's not doing anything that we think is inappropriate to be in a traditional Disney movie. And same thing with the National Treasure. So as we expand what all of this means and really letting the product define who we are and what we're about, but you're going to find much more concentration on the Disney side.
Are you going to hold the total count content in that world? Are we assuming less of other
grants, or is it kind of going to go up?
No, no, you'll have less Touchstone movies. Yeah, you know, over the course of over the next few years and all, you'll see less. The total number will remain about the same, give or take one or two, but the mix will be much more Disney than Touchstone. And it'll be, you know, it doesn't mean we're still not going to make a Touchstone movie. We will. And but I think, again, we'll be kind of picky on which ones we decide to make.
Has your total budget gone up?
No, it's about the same. We're going to keep it the same as it is. I think we can, if we're smart about the way in which we spend our money, I think we can definitely live within our budget.
It's more of a reallocation.
Okay.
Yeah.
And on the DVD side, when we first did slow down, are you experiencing that just in pricing, or is it also in number of units?
Well, we have seen a slowdown in the industry has seen a slowdown in the number of units. The buys per household have gone down slightly, so that's why you saw a little bit of decline in the video market. It's been the last few months it's been relatively firm. So
units or pricing down?
Both. So you know we've been in pretty good shape. But again, I said the buys per household have declined from last year, and so we've seen a slight decline in the market overall.
Right.
But what we've seen is in the last few months has been pretty firm for us. Yes.
I think we have said something like we for the industry as a whole, the like a 10% unit decline in 2005, calendar 2005, something like that. Or 10%.
Probably a little bit less than that. Yeah, less than that. I think it was off in the single digits. But as you expect to see the buys per household decline as the penetration increases of DVD players, so it's still a robust, probably 12 per household, but you know it has flattened out.
Just talk a little bit about the window between the movie release and the DVD release, and obviously making huge investments in these card movies, and even though that window is shrinking between the movie release and the DVD release, when does it get to a point where it becomes cannibalistic to the box office itself when people know the DVD is coming out a month later?
Yeah, I don't know exactly where that is, and it probably will differ with movie to movie. You know, we've seen it shrink from, 6 months down to about 4 months. It seems to be about the right time now. With a pattern and the playoff, in order to get, you know, all of the money out of the theatrical release and to take advantage of even the sub-runs and the dollar breaks and all of that, it seems to be about the right amount of time. You know, give or take a week or two, and I'm sure there's, you know, depending on the movie, you could look at it and see whether or not it was some movies that may be, you know, 3.5 months too short, and other movies that may be, you know, 3 or 4 months, you know, too late. So it'll, but I think we've hit a pretty happy medium there. It seems to work.
It also depends on what the movie is. We're trying to find the right place to put it, so sometimes it will be longer simply because it's, you know, it's still in the holiday period. So.
How has that affected your relationships with the movie theater?
Good. I mean, we've pretty much we've kept to our 4 month window, you know, it's been good so far.
If you went to simultaneous release, do you think that would mean more total revenues and profits?
I think if we thought that, we would do that. So I mean, I think that as we talked about, it's really a launching pad for the DVD. It also, as you know, our television deals are formulaic in nature and relate to the box office. So if we, you know, we're very careful to not cannibalize our theatrical too much, otherwise we'll cannibalize our television revenue. So really, what we do is we're very hard looking at each window, looking at the timing of each window, to figure out how we can make the most money. I mean, that's what we try to do.
So the window is not a function of the relationship with the theaters. It's legacy is what is the most profitable and most efficient way for Disney to do it?
Yes. I mean, clearly we have in mind the relationship with theaters, but ultimately we're trying to make the most profit, yes.
Why wouldn't you change that formula if it's, you're implying, well, I'm thinking you're implying it's an outdated formula and it needs to incorporate, I'm starting your TV release, and it needs to incorporate other distribution channels, either current distribution channels or brand new ones.
I don't think I'd imply that. I'm not sure. You know, I think what we're trying to say is the theatrical exhibition of our film sets the value of that film on the rest of the chain. I think it's pretty foolhardy to think that you're going to be able to go, if they don't know about that movie, if they don't know it and haven't heard about that movie, that it is good, they're not going to be shelling out $20 to buy that movie if they don't know something about it or haven't seen something about it, heard that it's good, or have hopefully already seen that movie and then want to buy it. One of the great, and I'm sure you guys have taken a look at, you know, the difference between what a box office on a given movie and they have the same box office, but their DVD sales are markedly different, because when it comes to buying something and having it in your home, that's where the rubber meets the road. That means you really liked that movie. That's a movie you want to have in your library and you want to keep it. It's not something that you don't buy it on a whim, or at least most people don't buy it on a whim, that they're just going to, you know, see it once and then toss it away. It's something you want to keep. It's one of the advantages that we have had in the relationship between the box office and the number of DVDs we sell have been greater, especially on Disney movies, because those are the kinds of movies that families typically want to have in their library for their kids and for their families or their grandkids or whatever. I don't think for a second that someone was going to take an 8 Below. An 8 Below so outperformed at the box office compared to what everyone thought it was going to do. We're going to end up at 80-some million dollars at the box office. Had we gone out with that simultaneously or close to it, I don't think we will sell. It's going to be a big, hopefully, knock on wood, a big DVD seller as well, because audiences loved it. It fits right into the kinds of movies that we do well, and we'll be able to market. I wouldn't even want to venture what we would have done, but it would be far, far less than had that movie had the proper platform in order to set its value in all the other markets, and including DVD.
And then Cars, for example, that you really have a lot of confidence in, would it be fair to assume that you might be willing to put that one a lot closer to the theatrical release?
No. Because I think it needs to have that fair launch of the movie. That hopefully, if Cars is as good as we hope that it will be, it will have a long life throughout the entire summer in theaters. And then it'll have a chance to play out in the suburban theaters. No. It's just gaining momentum, and for us, you know, we're looking at, you know, when does that title would go on sale, and the best time for that movie to go on sale is at the holiday time when people are buying their gifts for Christmas or for the holidays. So we would, we would save it or have it so that it would come out during the prime selling season for that good family title.
Then when do you think you might test a you know, higher price point download of the movie simultaneously to the box office? I think I heard Bob Iger say that you were considering like a $30 download into the home.
I think that, you know, I think what Bob was referring to, and you know, maybe you can ask him when he's here, is we're looking at all different models. We don't have a set time for a test like that. But what we're continually doing is, as you guys are asking all these questions, we spend a large part of our day dealing with exactly these very questions, you know, making sure what is the right timing, what is the right price. So, you know, we're looking at everything right now, but we don't have a set time.
But when you're talking about the simultaneous release, you're talking about current, as the market is currently, the $15 DVD.
Well, I think maybe Bob can answer what specifically you were referring to. But all I can say is we're looking at a variety of ideas right now. And what we're implementing, what we have now is what we believe is the most profitable model. And as it evolves, we certainly will change. As you've seen, the theatrical as you've seen, the theatrical window shortened from 6 to 4 months. I mean, everything continues to evolve. 4 months may be the right place, and this is where we think it is now, and that's why we're here.
Even if the industry has a successful year this year, there are many who would say that the live theatrical experience has deteriorated over the years. I don't know if it's due to the concentrated nature of the industry now. Would you agree with that? And if you do, what can a studio do, since you don't own the theaters, to help improve that experience?
Well, and you know, it's hard to make blanket statements. I don't want to. Clearly, the movie-going experience needs to be great. And I think there are many exhibitors that are doing just that with the advent of employing digital cinema, enlarging the screens, stadium seating, looking at the entire kind of ambiance of going to the movie. There are some great examples of some theaters in Florida with a local theater owner that is doing unbelievable business by having all these kinds of amenities, having a nursery or a crying room that you can take your kids into if they're misbehaving and not miss anything. You're able to see the movie, but you're behind a glass area and the kids are playing around. You know, I think about that, offering different restaurant opportunities, parking. You know, there are a number of ways I think that exhibitors are clearly looking at how to make that experience better. We do operate a single theater in Hollywood, the El Capitan Theater. And while it's just one theater, it is, in fact, the highest grossing single theater in the world. And this theater is, it operates, we have premium pricing. We have a lot of amenities that perhaps others don't. We have a big screen. We have ushers that help people down the aisle to make things. We hopefully have a wide variety of concessions that can be purchased. And the experience of that theater is, you know, we think second to none. Other theaters, other exhibitors take note of that all the time. We have a lot of exhibitors that come and look at that theater all the time to see how, in fact, it operates. And
some theater makes money?
It makes a lot of money. It makes a lot of money. And it...
These folks are going to be in a Kimmel tonight. It's across the street.
Well, you know, it's right next to you. I invite you to go by and take a look at it and look next door. It's got a little soda fountain we put in there this last that has added to that whole little area. And I think other exhibitors are doing the same sorts of things. And so hopefully by setting a good example and encouraging them. And this last year, as an example, we were the first to do the digital 3D of Chicken Little. And it was expensive to do. But we wanted to do that. We wanted to be the first. We wanted to start that whole thing in motion to get that, to get the digital projectors out there, and also to have a commitment that you need to have something different. You need to have something different, unique, and something that's going to enhance the movie-going experience. We thought that the 3D with Chicken Little would do just that. And, of course, the 100 theaters, we were the best grossing in the country. So it clearly added to that experience. And now, you know, there are a number of studios that are starting, and it's starting to proliferate, and hopefully by the time I think if Sony's Monster House comes out in July, they'll have 300 or 400, maybe even 500 theaters that will be equipped to do that. So it's slow, but it's coming, and I think those are the ways in which the movie-going experience will be enhanced. And it clearly has to be. I think, you know, just the public, it demands it.
Yeah. Do you guys work with the movie theaters to subsidize them in some way to promote that experience for them? Have you guys ever
considered
that?
We have not. You know, we try to spend our money to put on the screen the best product we can. And it's really, I think, up to the exhibitor to make that experience the best they can. And, you know, hopefully between the two, you know, we'll be able to make this, we'll continue to make it a very vibrant and exciting business.
And we also spend a lot of money to promote it with the advertising, so that...
Like
tea popcorn, and that works. Okay, one quick question. I was trying to ask this question. Who makes pizza? Pizza, the one genius guy running the right team, or what makes them so pizza?
Well, Pixar is obviously a very, very special place. There's no one reason why it is so great. It's great because of the accumulation of some very, very talented people who have developed over the last 15 years or so, a very unique culture. It's a creative culture. It's driven by creative. It is giving, it's caring, but the underlying kind of philosophy is, you know, no movie before its time. And what I mean by that, there's just no amount of quality that is too much to put into the movie. It doesn't mean, and I think, you know, John Lasseter would be the first to say that, you know, no movie they've made has been the perfect movie. But I think it has been as good a movie as they know how to make at that time.
The culture can be sustainable?
Oh, I think it could be sustainable, and I think it can be, I think there's so many good things that could be gleaned from that for other cultures that you want to establish. I think, you know, the culture that will be at Feature Animation, Disney Feature Animation, will be their own culture because it's their own people. But the same idea of having a very, they have a creative group that's very trusting, is very critical of their own. And you know, they work on something and everybody works on it to make it the very best it can be. And, you know, and that's not to minimize the talents of John Lasseter and Ed Catmull. I mean, their leadership, and along with Steve Jobs, has been pretty fantastic. You know, Steve, I think creating this kind of arena to play in, and then having someone of Ed's ability and John's ability, which are, you know, they're two very, very unique talents. But I think it runs so deep into that company that it's not just one or two people, but it's literally, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people that share in the vision of, you know, we're going to try to do the very best we can every single time. And that's pretty great.
I've just shot myself in the focus room. Take one more question.
Part of what you were saying, there have been rumors that there have been cultural integration issues, but can you comment on that? That wasn't my question, but... You know, you've been in this business for a long time. The industry went through a rough period last year. What did you learn about yourself? What did you learn about the business? And where do you kind of see things in the business industry in the next 5 years moving?
Let me do the Pixar question first about the integration. Quite honestly, I think the integration is happening better than we'd ever dreamed it would. It has been... It's been a thrill to watch how it's all taken place. The excitement, both at Pixar and at Disney Feature Animation, I think has never been higher than it is now. I think our artists are very, very excited. You know, John is, you know, he's a bit of a Pied Piper, kind of saying, you know, and his attitude, Ed's attitude, and what they've been able to bring to both ends has been great. The integration has just been, you know, knock on wood, it's just been terrific, and I see no reason why it shouldn't continue. You know, I think the lessons, it all comes back to, I think, what we talked about earlier. It's product, and product, and it's the decisions that I don't know that there is a place anymore for the, I'll call it the programmer, the movie that just kind of you just make and put out there because it fills a particular slot and it might get a particular audience on. It's too expensive to do those kinds of movies. I think every movie needs to have a purpose.
Every movie, you know, has to have the right place and the right time for it. It has to have the right financial box put around it so that it has the best opportunity to succeed. These are all things I think everybody has known for years, but having a year like last year just brings it back again and hits you between the eyes. I think it also, you know, we're living in this huge kind of transitional kind of time where whether it's in the production of our movies are changing, you know, how many people are now shooting it in high definition instead of film. You're seeing the way movies are distributed. You know, you're seeing the consolidation of exhibition. When I first started in the sales area and distribution, I think we had 16 offices around the country. Now we have 2. You know, you're seeing a lot of different things that have kind of taken place. You're seeing now in technology all these different formats, all these new things that are coming out that we're having to, you know, that we must look at, you know, the windows and where they fit and how's the best and how best to exploit it. You know, advertising. You know, advertising turns into be, you know, with all of the different challenges that you have because you have, you know, this almost unlimited number of channels now. You have unlimited amounts of, you know, where do you spend your money on internet, newspapers. The newspaper is less than the internet. Where do people get their information? All these things are constantly changing. And so it's, you know, it's really incumbent upon us to, you know, not kind of be wedded to the past, but to constantly look at other, better, smarter, cheaper, hopefully, ways of reaching the public. But you never stop learning. You know, you just, it changes all the time. And, you know, we'll be back and how will be asking the same question, you know, to how in the world, what did you learn last year? You know, what was the, you know, did, in the box office, we just had all sorts of records. Does that mean it's back? And as soon as you say that, then you know you're going to go into a funk. You just kind of look at it and, you know, having been here for a long time, kind of have the opportunity of looking at it kind of from a longer term, you know, and not worrying so much about a season, a year. There are behavioral things that are changing. Those are the things I think we have to be mindful of, how people are really consuming our entertainment.
Good, thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You did a great job.
Oh, man.
Don't tell you.
What did you say?
I can be consistent.
Oh, good. So I don't have to take any of it.
I'm joined by Bob Iger, our CEO. And, you know, Bob, I don't know if you want to start with any general comments first about our strategy, and then talk to Liz Norris.
No, I think. No, let's jump in. No
okay.
issue.
You know
pretty
much. Because you're a host.
Yes, and you've seen Dick and
then Andy Bird after you.
Okay.
And Jimmy Kimmel tonight.
Maybe start by your announcement that you made yesterday with ABC and having shows on the internet. And I was kind of curious indeed to hear what your thoughts were and how the affiliates felt about that. And maybe if you can give us your just a perspective of the announcement and where you're coming from. And maybe this is sort of the value of going forward in terms of potential limitations or maybe kind of give us your whole view about your thoughts on the industry.
Well, first of all, it was an ABC announcement. I obviously was aware of it. They've taken me through their thoughts about this over the last number of months, really. And what they did was very consistent with what I have been trying to do with the company in terms of a strategic priority, and that is to first and foremost invest in great content, content that's in demand, in this case television shows, and then move it to customers as aggressively as possible to really do two things. One, to broaden reach, obviously, in a world that is much more fragmented than ever before, and two, to diversify or expand revenue streams. A lot of what is going on right now in terms of moving content onto new platforms, I wouldn't call it all experimental. It is educational. Meaning, I believe it is a given that content that is being made for traditional platforms will migrate onto what I'll call non-traditional platforms on a permanent basis. But what we don't know yet is we don't know
truly about consumer behavior. We don't know about pricing. We don't know fully about what works best from a timing perspective. But we're committed as a company to really learning and learning fast, because I remain rather sobered by the experience that the music industry had. Whether they were stubborn or I don't necessarily want to accuse them of anything, but the bottom line is that they were not in tune with what their customers wanted, what the world was demanding of them, and I think it hurt them significantly. I don't want to wake up and see all the traffic moving on the new platforms and us not being there, or all of the revenue moving on the new platforms and us not being there. And we've already seen a pretty dramatic increase in advertising on new internet space, and we occupy that space on a very limited basis. And we should have license to occupy more of that. So I am, to say that I'm aggressive might be an understatement here. And I'm thoroughly pleased with what ABC did. And we're going to do more of it as a company on other sites. As it relates to what I'll call our traditional distribution partners, whether you're talking about mass retailers, theater owners, or television affiliates, or cable companies, I think that we have created a lot of value together. We've grown our businesses together, with us investing in content and these entities investing in what I'll call distribution, whether it's brick and mortar like a mass retailer, or whether it's an antenna like an affiliate, or pipes like cable. We create a lot of value together. We're not looking to in any way destroy that value. I actually believe that we're going to continue with these traditional partners to create a lot of value for both sides for a long time to come. We're not looking to abandon them. We're not looking to betray them. We're not looking to do anything that is designed to harm their business. But at the same time, what we can't do is we can't let a fear of that relationship being challenged or creating tension with them get in the way of following the consumers who are going to other places. Just can't do that. And it's a tough balancing act, because everything is sort of tied. You know, that you can't do anything in an isolated form. You can't make any move in one direction that doesn't have an impact in the former direction in a way. What it is, I don't know. I don't believe that we're cannibalizing. I don't believe, what we see is a world that is consuming more media because technology is giving them the ability to do that. So I think in the end, we have a greater opportunity as a company if we invest right creatively than we've ever had before. This is a world that is expanded, not contracted, in terms of that opportunity. And the trick is to figure out a way to balance what I'll call current and prior businesses with the need to take advantage of these opportunities. And it's that simple. And I think, unfortunately, the answer to your question in general is I don't know fully. I don't know what the impact is going to be fully, except that we have an obligation when we make great content to see to it that it gets in the hands of as many people as possible, and that we're paid for it in as diverse a way as possible, whether it's direct to consumer through third parties, advertiser supported, VOD, linear, non-linear, aggregated, disaggregated, intermediated, disintermediated. So
we don't have a idea of 5 or even 10 years from now where the bulk of your consumers might be. Clearly not where they are now, clearly not where they were, but will they be so that, I mean, all those things you just mentioned, there's going to be little pieces of consumers getting content from all these different places, or will it gravitate toward one?
Now, I have ideas. I try not to express them, sorry, in ways that create any more controversy. Because it was in an earnings call that I was asked a question about movie windows, and I must have put 10 caveats on it, and I still got quoted as basically being in favor of, maybe the only one in favor of, other than Mark Cuban, of essentially putting DVDs out at the same time as we have motion pictures, and someone called it a death threat against the industry, which is not what I meant to in any way indicate. We're already seeing world that is somewhat chaotic in nature in terms of where people are and where and how people are accessing media. There's just a lot more. What I mean by that is it's a lot more different times in different places, and then meaning they get it, and then they're consuming it at different times in different places than ever before. But there's also still a lot of order to it. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to prove to both the motion picture, to the theater owners, to the retailers, and to traditional distributors, that when you have a show that's as strong as Grey's Anatomy or Desperate Housewives or Lost, people want to watch it as soon as it's available. And there's mass consumption that is what I'll call momentary in nature. Because it just is when you put a DVD on the shelves of Walmart, the traffic that it generates right away and the buy rates that you see when it first goes on the shelf are higher than, you know, longer periods of time. I don't see that changing. That's what I mean by order. When we put out Pirates this summer or Cars or Fox put out Ice Age, people knew that they could wait 6 months or 3 months to buy a DVD, but they all went to the movies to see it because they feel that it's good or they know that it's good and they want to get it right away. I don't see that change. That's why I really believe that the value for what I'll call the initial distributors is going to continue. But what is going to change is how fast it is then available on other platforms for consumers who either didn't get a chance to go right away, didn't want to go right away, or didn't even hear about it right away until they heard of some mass consumption. High School Musical is an interesting example. We put it on the Disney Channel. It's probably aired 15 times. And yet the downloads on iTunes are pretty significant, a lot from people who never even saw it because they heard it's getting high ratings, it must be interesting, I better find a way to get it. So I guess what I'm suggesting is you're going to see probably more chaos than we've ever seen before, but it's not necessarily going to be the complete expensive order.
Clearly, and I guess a lot of us are investors, we clearly believe you that the value is in the content. Does that mean that there's a diminution of value in distribution, and that will continue over time? All forms of distribution will have lesser and lesser value over time.
That's not we're really not in the distribution business, so it's not really for me to answer. There's a lot more competition in both directions, content and distribution. There's a lot more. What the growth of media has done is it's created more opportunities for either content or what I'll call new experiences that take the place of people consuming traditional content. So whether it's blogs or podcasts or chatting on the web or simply surfing the internet like mad, people are spending time doing that instead of consuming traditional media. And so as makers of content initially for traditional media, we've got a lot of competition for people's time, just as distributors have a lot more competition in terms of how content is moved from the creator to the consumer. As a company, we're making our bet on content. So I don't mean that to suggest that distribution is a commodity or decrease in terms of size as there's more and more opportunities. Content works for us. It's what we've done best as a company. We've had peaks and valleys in that regard. Look at ABC, but at least right now the company's in relatively good shape there. And as we look to allocate our capital, and fortunately for us, we've managed to deliver some pretty strong free cash flow growth, and we are on a path to continue that for the foreseeable future. We're going to have to make decisions in terms of how we allocate our capital. Where do we invest it? How do we create growth? How do we deliver more shareholder value? And as we look at one of the primary metrics to make the decision, which is return on invested capital, we believe that the best way to do that is in the direction of content, and in particular branded content. So our focus on investing in mostly Disney-branded content has grown tremendously. And the same is true for ESPN. And there are different factors associated. And ESPN, what we're really trying to do, to steal Warren Buffett's words, is we're trying to widen the moat. Our investment in content there, whether it's licensed from third parties or original, is to widen the moat around that brand to make it much harder for competitors to come in. And widening the moat, we're getting access to more and more revenue, and we're turning that revenue and ultimately the profitability back into investing in the brand. And so buying NASCAR is a great example of what I'll call moat widening. I also believe that spending some money today to protect that brand long-term is valuable. In Disney, we have a brand that is extremely well-known, that is respected and admired, that many of us in this room, I believe, sort of grew up with. We want that to continue. And we found that for the more competitive world, we were being challenged in that regard. Whether it was Nickelodeon in its heyday or Pixar, there were more entrants into the space. And so I concluded, which is what drove the Pixar acquisition, that we had to invest more in the Disney brand, and high quality content is the best way to do it. So you're going to see a lot of examples of that. I don't know whether Dick took you through his mix of movies, but we've looked carefully at our return on investment in the movie business. The live-action movie business in general has delivered very, very unimpressive results for investors for many years. If you look at the Disney business, the results are actually pretty strong. And so our focus there, as part of the overall investment in the Disney brand, but in part to make better sense of the movie business, to invest much more in that direction. And to go back to your question about distribution, I can't comment much about that, except that we believe, given all the people simply knocking at our door, that with great content, the opportunities are actually greater than we've ever seen before. And just look at growth of multi-channel systems or homes globally. That's given us the ability to put Desperate Housewives in hundreds of markets, which we would not have had before. You would have been dealing with essentially close to monopoly, government-owned terrestrial broadcasters and with limited space. And we've always sold television programs internationally, but we've never seen the frenzy that we see today. The investment that ABC made in that product is starting to pay off, and we're actually seeing opportunities that are better. We've seen iPod's obviously a good example of that, but so is Verizon. We did a long-term deal with Verizon. The list is almost endless these days of people who want access to this. So we like where we're positioned in this world, even though there are probably a significant number of unknowns. Just as an aside, in 1956, Walt Disney was asked to write something for a time capsule to go into the Colgate-Palmolive building in New York. And they were asking him to project what the world would look like in entertainment 50 years hence, 2006. So the person who helped him write it is still at the company, still here, a guy named Marty Sklar. And he unearthed it. I don't know what made him find it, but maybe it was the 50-year thing. Here it is 50 years later, and it's a page and a half. I just got it last week. It's unbelievable what he says about the world. And he kind of nails it. And he says that no matter what the world looks like, and I'm not saying it in the right words, although I can go on my own to get it, that people will still want to be entertained and refreshed. It's interesting that he picked up the word refreshed, because he had opened Disneyland a year earlier. There's another word that he used as well as entertainment and refreshment. I can't recall it. And I actually believe that's the case in the world that we're looking at, that no matter what changes technologically or distribution-wise, whether it's aggregated or linear or all those terms that I use, a great piece of material is a great piece of material, and people will demand it. We'll figure out ways to get it to them. It may be different than what we did in the past, but it'll be good. It's a good investment.
I was at the cable show yesterday and this morning, and I guess the buzz from the cable operators were a little concerned whether or not you would consider putting streaming ESPN or some of your other digital networks. And was Lost and Grey's Anatomy unique in that they're advertising supported? They're obviously not getting fees and things like that like you are for some of your distributed cable companies. Could you score whether or not you would view at some point the prospect of streaming ESPN or maybe some of your
I had dinner with Brian Roberts on Sunday night, sitting next to him actually. There, and this before the announcement, but I know it's on his mind. We talk a lot about all of this. And the answer is probably not, because right now we're getting paid handsomely for ESPN by distributors, more than, as we all know, anyone else in the business, really. And the sub fees that we get from them, which are guaranteed for a fairly long period of time, given some of the deals that we've done, although clearly we've got a couple to go, including Comcast. But that's substantial. That's almost an annuity for us. It doesn't mean we can be complacent and not continue to invest in the content, but it's an incredible source of revenue that does not rise and fall with economies or fall prey to the same external force that advertising does. And if you look at the mix of revenue for ESPN, if you're looking at 65-70% of it is sub fees, the rest is advertising, whereas most cable channels are the opposite. So the knowns for ESPN are much greater than the unknowns revenue-wise. We'd be crazy to destroy that. We'd be crazy to put it at risk. And unless we can figure out a way to stream it and get paid kind of similar amounts of money, I would be hard-pressed to justify it. And in the negotiations with the Comcast of this world, believe me, this comes up. We don't have a desire to stream ESPN, you know, on a free basis, because it just wouldn't make no sense. Now, if we're already making certain programming and highlight packages available, but Five is very valuable when it comes to sports. There's also a lot of it. No one can watch, a real sports fan can never watch enough. And so there's always room for more. And that's why with the ESPN phone and ESPN 360, which is a broadband offering, ESPN radio and ESPN the magazine.
You started out today by saying that you do want to be sensitive to how your customers want your product. Now, if you won't, just throwing out pie in the sky, if ABC is a big hit, and you can't do it with ESPN for that obvious reason, well, maybe Rupert Murdoch can figure out he doesn't have the revenue stream for sports as you do, and he certainly would like it.
Yes, I know. Yes, I do, but as you know, there is some barrier to entry. Now, maybe Rupert is one who never cares about such things, but to step up and own a sport and license it that you can really turn around and turn into a big business takes a huge investment of money. Huge, billions of dollars. Look, the NFL is a great example of that. We paid over $1 billion. We agreed to pay over $1 billion a year to keep it on ESPN for 8 years. So we couldn't have stepped up, nor could anyone else easily, and agreed to an $8 billion commitment without some guaranteed revenue. So it's almost, turning around and look at the television network today. We invest hundreds of millions of dollars in programming, some that works and some that doesn't every year. And we're able to do that because we have a system that delivers, even in the down years, billions of dollars in advertising revenue that basically pays for that investment in programming. It would be hard to kind of start from scratch, not have a network, and simply say, here's a good analogy, we're Yahoo. So we're going to make television at $1 million an episode and put it out on our platform and hope that advertisers will sponsor it or that people will pay money for episodes. Now, can we get to a point where that happens down the road? I don't know. You know, people are getting used to doing more and more on new distribution platforms than ever before. And it's a long way out. It's the same thing with movies. It's very hard to make a movie and spend the kind of money you spend, even at the lowest end, and just put it on the internet for grabs. It's just a lot of risk associated with it. So the platforms that exist today, whether it's large screen theaters or program services that take movies on VOD or premium basis, I think they're going to continue to succeed, and they'll continue to be good partners of ours. We've got to figure out a balance, respect the present, because it enables us to afford the investment for the future, but also make sure that we're occupying this new space, because somebody will.
So everything that we've been talking about, you've been talking about so far, is pretty much centered on making sure that you have the best content and it's available across all sorts of distribution systems. What are you guys doing to ensure that that high-quality content is the right content for all these new kinds of distribution systems? Since there's, you know, a lot more portable stuff, smaller screens, all sorts of things that we haven't seen before and that, you know, frankly, aren't going to be terrific for something like Cars, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think this is a very good question. We are starting to develop content, specifically what we call shorter form content for smaller screens. We actually have a company, or a business company called Starwave Mobile that's doing just that, like Gambat did, for instance. We're doing the same thing, and we believe we're going to have to fund more of those internally to really think about these new platforms and it's a completely different experience, whether it's interactive product or this product that's shorter form in nature. Putting it on a small screen might be limiting in terms of the amount of time you spend in front of it. At the same time, we're going to experiment with a lot of traditional content on these new platforms and see what the consumer of tomorrow will really tolerate. I find it's valuable to put yourselves in your kids' shoes or eyes or brain instead of your own. I grew up in an environment where we didn't have cable and we didn't have a remote control on the TV and you had to get up and turn the channel. And, so I think when I started programming the network, I forgot that the moment you put something on that was uncomfortable or boring to a viewer, they had an ejection seat button in their hand called a remote control and they were gone. So when I put Cop Rock on the air, which was a police musical, every time there was a song, people felt really uncomfortable, and they closed with their thumbs. They were gone. And that's kind of, in a way, an example of that. You have to really be in tune. I think we're going to be surprised at what people will tolerate. I don't have enough data yet on the iTunes iPod experience. We're getting some, and Apple's been generous with us in sharing it, but it's not enough yet. But it's interesting what people will tolerate. And my wife flew back from Orlando to L.A. the other night with my kids, and I gave her my video iPod. I have a 7-year-old, and I loaded it with Disney Channel shows, which I paid $1.99 each for, by the way. Great. And
Apple's not being that generous, though.
No, I haven't even asked. I don't know. I probably would have SEC trouble or something if I did it. I don't know. And he watched the whole time. He sat with his iPod and headphones, and there were half-hour episodes. That High School Musical was on there at $9.99, but I don't think he watched that. But he watches all the Disney Channel shows. At least I have that influence over him. And didn't seem to have any fatigue factor. I mean, maybe you go on an airplane, you don't expect a big screen experience anyway. So I think we'll still have to see, but I believe that we need to do both, create new content, and we're investing in that direction, as well as move traditional content and see what happens.
If you had to sort of break down right now the amount of time and effort that you and your team spend between looking at all the distribution channels and dealing with things like the ABC announcement the other day and looking at sort of that next step to content that's going to work on all that stuff, what's the breakdown right now?
3/4, 1/4, meaning 1/4 looking at content specific to new platforms and 3/4 figuring out ways to distribute traditional on content onto non-traditional. Maybe even 80-20, I would guess.
Can you talk a little bit about...
Not an investment. Investment is probably 99% traditional because obviously when you make movies and traditional TV shows and a lot more money that goes into that than if you make a flash game for Disney.com.
Can you talk a little bit about what you think drives the streaming, you know, downloader on the internet of ABC shows? Would it be technology that ABC can offer in a sense that this downloads faster and it's more, you know, it's more easier, it's easier to access? Or does it really come down to you're going for the people who want to do it a legal way, didn't know how to download something before, and they're going that? Because, it's definitely out there. You can see without commercials now as it is. What do you think, you know, really drives that?
It's a little bit of both. And the more legitimate product we put out there, the more people will consume legitimate versus illegitimate.
Okay.
It will be easier to find. We're starting to put a fair amount of decoys out there on the web, too, where if you're a consumer and you go to a BitTorrent, you'll see, you know, 50 versions of, what's a good example, Chicken Little, and 10 of them are toad decoys. So if you download it, something that we put out that purposely doesn't work, we're going to do a lot more of that. So in the end, I think the legitimate stuff will simply be more reliable. More people will want to buy than steal. There'll still be pirates out there, don't get me wrong. But we feel that it's interesting because one of the debates that we're having now is over managed copies. And what happens when you sell someone a new next generation DVD? What license are you giving? Are you selling them? What can they do with that content? Can they rip it to an iPod, for instance? Well, the license for the traditional or standard def DVD says they can't. A lot of people are doing it, though. So there's a debate about whether we should just let them do it, because they're doing it anyway. Or maybe even ultimately on the next generation, sell them the right to do it. What I mean by that is baked into the price of the DVD is the license to make certain copies of it for use on other technologies. I think we have to be really smart about all that. We obviously spend a lot of time talking about it.
With more forms of distribution, on the one hand, that, you know, that side of the business being more fragmented, but on the other, more user-created and really low-cost content out there, albeit at lower quality than what you and your competitors are creating, do you feel like you're gaining more pricing power because the distributors have less, or do you feel like pricing power is eroding?
Well, I think the real dynamic that we're seeing that ultimately helps us is that the more distributors there are out there, the more important it is for them to have access to the best content and the best brands, because without it, they have a tough time penetrating their market. And that gives us some, when I say pricing power, let's be careful. It doesn't mean we're necessarily driving prices up dramatically, but it gives us the ability to maintain prices in a world that's fragmenting a little bit more. I also think it's one of the reasons why we're really looking to invest in a brand-focused way as a company, too. I mean, just look at the difference between a Touchstone movie and a Disney movie to a distributor or a consumer's eyes is pretty significant.
Why do you think you're more willing to risk the affiliate relationships or risk that awkward than CBS and Fox tend to be? Simply that they own a greater percentage of their affiliates, or is there something structurally?
Do you sense that we are more willing to take risks? You're concluding that. I kind of see it in a vacuum.
Speed of action.
What's driving them, honestly. I've actually found it valuable to focus more on us than them. I mean, it's not disrespectful, either of them or of you, for asking the question. I just am maniacal about really watching what the consumer is doing today. And I'm a pretty avid user of new technology myself, how I spend my time, and I just think that it's important for our business and for us to deliver value to all of you, for us to take a more forward approach. We're not going to be right all the time. It could create some fallout, but I think we're learning valuable lessons to come, and Anthony, I think in the end we'll be better prepared for the world. We do business in and not have it pass us by.
Would you have made the same decision if you did own, 40% of the reach, your affiliates?
I would hope so. I don't. I mean, it's a good question. I hadn't thought about it, but I hope so.
I found it interesting talking to some of the affiliates I'm not suggesting it was a bad strategy. I actually think it was a good strategy because it didn't sound like you were worried your affiliates that you were going to go in that direction. And now it sounds like what you're going to try to do is you're going to move forward with this type of strategy, and now you'll need to go and talk to the affiliates.
Yeah.
Because it seems like if you were to work it the reverse, you probably would never have gotten
it. I don't know whether Ann had dialogue with them or not. I am one step or or two removed from that, and I actually did not ask her whether she did or did not, but I found that if you seek permission from your traditional partners, it's much, you're typically going to get a no, because of the obvious. Everybody wants to protect
that.
You know, I said at our annual meeting this year, the riskiest thing we could do as a company is maintain the status quo. It kind of falls, you know, the comment falls into that category a bit. That protecting a lot of people want to protect the status quo. Why we'd love things not to change. In the meantime, it's changing a lot, and we can't ignore that. I think again, it's sort of what I'm trying to implore the company to do. And Dick and I mean, he was just here. We had a lot of discussions about this. He gets the squawking from some very, very important partners of his, and it's very, very difficult bucking the trend or showing what they perceive to be a disrespect or lack of appreciation for their business. The same token, I don't think customers today really care that much. They don't really think about business models or distributors or... I'm not even sure they think first about technology. It's, here's a piece of content that I might like access to at the right time and the right price. Today's world gives them the ability to exercise that right much easier than ever before.
You stated that your focus on brand was, your brief focus on brand was to kind of maintain pricing and keep pricing. Is the drive to alternative channels a desire to, I mean, is it to revenue or is it to just maintain revenue and maintain pricing and to try to capture? Or is it actually really?
We're not looking to move to alternate channels. You mean just to create price leverage with initial channels?
Just to keep pricing as it is or maintain the pricing stability that you have. Or is it actually incremental revenue opportunities?
Might be a little bit of both.
Are you recognizing or seeing that you're going down a slippery slope in pricing, so you need to aggressively go after the other channel?
I don't think we're necessarily going down a slippery slope in terms of pricing, per se. We haven't seen dramatic decrease in pricing. Certainly haven't in charging we charge for our channels. It's actually gone up. Now it's moderated a bit, but for good reason. DVD pricing is, generally speaking, been relatively stable, and I actually think that the next generation DVD, if the industry would only get its act together, could actually help us maintain pricing as just a better consumer experience. So I think more than anything, it's we're doing this to help people are gravitating in this direction. And you know, you get a portable device, you're going to want to use it. Someone's going to put content on it, might as well be us. It's kind of my approach.
Is the ad sales on the TV side, is it television-like or is it internet-like? And along with that, would you ever...
It's not banner ads.
Is it per click or is it based on a consumption of the...
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's one price for advertising, at least in this trial. The folks that are buying on ABC.com are buying at a fixed negotiated price.
There isn't a click. Well, I guess there's a click. It's like a rating.
Right.
But per episode? Per time slot per episode?
Right, and there might be one advertiser for the whole episode. And the advertising is likely to be more interactive than what you'd see, obviously, on the television window, where there might be a choice of three ads that come up from a car manufacturer. For example, depending on your interest in which car you have more interest on, you can watch that ad as opposed to the other two ads.
But you have to watch one. What I find is interesting about it from an advertiser perspective is for years, advertisers have been worried about either the impact of the PBR or about people spending more time doing things online than on TV, for instance. And in many respects, we're answering a need here that they have, and they stepped up with great enthusiasm. Even if it's not a given it's going to work, because it isn't, we don't know yet, they love the fact that we're giving them an opportunity to put what is a more traditional ad on a relatively traditional product in a non-traditional platform.
And it's interesting, your list of advertisers, they're all companies that existing search and banner ads don't really work for their business.
Right, although we have companies that have or that are in the search and banner ad business too quite successfully that are also interested. Fair amount.
But there's a big untapped market of advertisers that would like to embrace the internet.
But can't because it doesn't
work
for them.
It doesn't really work.
That's right. There's a huge untapped market of advertisers who know that their customers are getting information and consuming media in other places and they desperately want to be there. Just think about the advertisers that bought radio. And all of a sudden, they see a lot of people who are either listening to satellite radio or downloading songs from iTunes onto their iPod and listening to music without any commercials. And they don't know what to do. Really, where do they go? So we're trying, in a way, to answer their needs, too. And I think there's a real first mover advantage. You know, the world will catch up to us. But,
but when do you think that the revenues that Disney generates from a lot of these non-traditional distribution channels will become significant and you will find significant?
Well, it's not today, obviously. Even iTunes, which has been, we put in the immensely successful category, still generating relatively little revenue compared with what we generate on ABC, for instance. Oh, I don't know. I don't know what would you define as significant? General percentage of total revenue of what? 10%? 5%?
It'll impact earnings. I mean, noticeably. I mean, is it 1% of sales, $300 million, or? There's a lot of discussion about it, and it's nice for multiple, but in terms of actual
money and
shareholders.
It's a good question.
Are the economics similar to what you currently have, better? And how much better if they are?
Well, they're different economics. I mean, the iTunes is $1.99, and it's been reported it's roughly 70-30 split. So compared with what? Economics, I don't know.
In terms of incremental margins, too, like if you lump it all in one.
I
mean, are you bringing it down to the...
The programming charges are charged.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's incremental.
Well, all incremental, there's a debate that's going on just within these walls, not this conference room, this building. About is it incremental or are we cannibalizing ourselves? We don't know. I don't know the answer to your question. We'll know it when we see it. I think it's going to happen sooner rather than later, though. I think we've got a very fast-moving consumer today.
And that's why it's very important that you're doing these things and being out of that. I want to ask you a profitability question about parks and resorts. If I could shift gears for a second.
We're going back to traditional business.
parks and resorts.
That's right. It's just interesting. We just spent 45 minutes talking about stuff that is not even close to being significant on a lot of mind basis, but it's amazing. I think we all have that interest because we've all seen the world is changing. It's just interesting, though. This is the first question I'm going to get that is sort of more traditionally based.
Okay.
Sorry.
The partners were a great cash cow and also some growth characteristics to it. We'll do cutback on cutback in the last few years. But margins are at very low levels, at 13% or so in 2005. They've been as high as kind of the low 20s. What are the people in the division doing to improve it?
We've talked about a 20% margin.
Yeah.
Yes, correct. Which we're creeping up to.
No, on an apples-to-apples basis, we're at 20% plus. Last year, we were at 17.3.
Yeah. I was going to say
high teens. Okay.
There's some distortion. We can get into the details if you want on some of the accounting
requirements
in the last few years.
So then on apples-to-apples versus the prior numbers, that 20 would be... maybe 17 or so, right? So you have another 500 to get to kind of where they were before 9/11. Is that
There's a lot that we're doing. A lot.
There's a lot of money in that.
Yeah, I could tick off a lot of different things, but having just been in Orlando, supposedly vacationing for 5 days, which is the biggest joke in the world, I just go to Morton Reservation Center, as for instance. And we've invested some capital, and some human capital, too, in completely changing our approach reservations-wise. And in the last year, we did 5 million calls to the reservation center. One, we've gotten a lot more efficient at it. Two, we've gotten much more effective at how we sell, including just how we segment the salesmen to people who are what I'll call givens in terms of booking, to people who are, you know, on the lower end, and how we funnel those calls, and ultimately the kind of packages that we attempt to sell them has changed a lot.
Some hotel stay, that's
correct. I'll get to that. Just interestingly enough, every second of time on a call costs about $50,000, and we may have managed to reduce the amount of call time significantly and reduce our cost of sales by just having a more robust internet site. And so the people who come to the phone are much more educated than they've ever been, and it shortens the length of the call. It also greatly increases the ability to conclude and to make the deal, because you have a much more educated customer when they get to the phone. It is, and hopefully more entertained ever before, because if you go to our websites, you can actually see footage of our attractions and sample hotel rooms and venues at our restaurants, and it's all improving basically our ability to sell. That's one. Things like the investment in capital in all the hotel rooms, both high-end and low, gave us a fair amount of market leverage, and we then made a deal with the airport, which we just extended to 2011, where if you stay in one of our hotels on property, whether you're staying at a $1,000 a night room at the Grand Floridian or a $100 a night room at Pop Century, you can tag your bags at home, land at the Orlando airport, and they will show up in your room. You don't go to a baggage claim, which is a huge incentive for people to move from other property hotels to on. There are many marketing to markets that we were just underpenetrated in. There was a point where we weren't even focused on that. There are actual cities in the United States where we get less attendance than we should to Orlando, which is obviously the mothership given its size. Spending time and money in those markets is another way to improve margins. The things that we do to different demographics, whether it's the Hispanic marketing effort we've done or the multi-generational approach where people are vacationing more often than larger family groups, and what we do there, how we sell to them, but how we accommodate them, is just another example. There's still...
Pricing
strategy, the $1,500 package for a family of four for a week, pretty interesting. While I was there, we were selling in the marketplace a heavily discounted meal plan for the hurricane season. And that was essentially because once people have booked, they tend not to cancel, even if there's a threat of a hurricane. Obviously, if there's a hurricane hitting your property, they're not coming. So by getting people to book earlier for that period of time, we increase the chances that our park attendance is going to be higher during that period of time. So we went into the marketplace with an expensive food plan, which we hadn't had before, and it was working.
Also something like best practices, for example, Disneyland has had rising occupancy in the hotels for the last 4 or 5 years, whereas Disney World has been falling. Is there anything like that, or...
Well, the whole move to increase occupancy, whether it's what we did with the baggage, or we now extend park hours to hotel residents, our hotel occupants only. So every night in Orlando, a park is open an hour later. I think sometimes we open earlier, too, just for people who are staying in our hotels. We empty the park completely to do that and then let them come back in, which is a pretty easy thing to do. And it's fantastic. You're incentivized to stay in our hotel because the experience you have is better because there are fewer people in the park for that reason. And we've increased occupancy rates just by doing that. So there's a lot of thought going into this, a lot going on. some traditional investment as well to get the margins up, whether you're putting Expedition Everest in, which I think will pay dividends for a long time for this company, or a new, we just announced a new Nemo musical in a theater that was previously occupied by a Tarzan show in Orlando. There's a lot, so there's just a lot going on.
So the last follow-up, and so the 20%, is that a kind of a realistic target or an aggressive target?
We wouldn't make it. Well, it's both. We wouldn't make it if we didn't feel it was realistic. But it doesn't happen with a snap of a finger.
Right. Not that you, so it's possible you could exceed it if you feel.
I'm looking just to hit it right now. There's also, you know, there are practice issues and our approach there, and it's a lot.
Yeah.
What are you legally positioned in terms of a company owning a ship and a land-based resort? Why is it that you're able to run ships at 105% every single cruise?
It's amazing.
But you can't do that with a hotel. What is the difference? Especially since
it's a highly differentiated experience. First of all, we have a lot less capacity on our ships, meaning we have two ships. I don't know how many beds each one has, but it's about 1,000 each, roughly, versus you would just multiply our rooms by beds. I guess 1,000 staterooms each.
Yeah. 2,000.
Versus 40,000 roughly. And so you know, we have a lot less capacity. We are a premium price product to the market. But we're also a family product. So we're very uniquely positioned in that market. You know, you can't have the kind of pure family vacation on a or family cruise on any other ship that you have on Disney, the level of entertainment, the quality of the service. So that's enabled us not only to maintain consistency in terms of sun occupancy, what's the load factor?
Yield.
Sorry. But also the pricing that we get. Just we built these two beautiful ships and we provide people, have you been on one?
No.
It's quite, I sailed this past summer in Mexico. It's quite an experience for a family. Memorable. Kids cry. My kids cry when we left. they cried.
Couldn't you have some kind of, my understanding is part of it is, it's the experience, but part of it is also a pricing mechanism where you can figure out in advance if you're not going to be filled, you do something with discounts. Can't you do something like that with all your hotels?
We don't have an occupancy problem in our hotels, by the way. We're running occupancy rates that are much higher than the marketplace. In Orlando, for instance, I think at least 10 points higher, probably. And I don't want to say anything we haven't said publicly. So what was our last?
Tammy, do you remember from our last earnings call?
So where in the 80s was occupancy?
But I think the difference between in a hotel, the difference between a
few points.
Those last few points.
I understand. Well, that's why we're doing what we're doing, all the things that I described. To get the occupancy up, and we've seen a rise in occupancy in general. But it's just a very different product. But there are things we can do. We're converting. We noticed a trend in family suites, both in family suites. We didn't have it. So we're converting rooms in the All-Star, which is a lower price, moderately priced hotel, to family suites, as for instance. We're reacting very quickly to marketplace changes, just basically to maintain or grow occupancy. There are a lot of examples of that. The $1,500 package, what we offer in terms of meal costs, the baggage, all the other amenities, the character experiences that you get only at our hotels. We're actually, in general, putting more entertainment in our hotels than ever before. Plus, high-speed internet access. And typically, when we built these, we didn't want people staying in their hotels. So we didn't build great pools. We didn't put big TVs in. That's all changing. You go to even our lower-priced hotels, the new ones, you see flat-panel TVs, internet access, beautiful pools. As we extend length of stay, we realize people have to spend more time in our hotels because you just can spend so much time in our parks with little kids, particularly if you're like me and you've been 50s.
How has your experience been different than what you expected?
My job?
Yeah. Just so far, and the challenges you face, and on a kind of a second, you just read the time capsule for Walt Disney.
if you could ask him, what advice do you think he'd give you?
I've studied enough of Walt to get a pretty good sense. He fortunately is enough writing and recording that you can listen, and the legacy is still pretty strong at the company. So we don't go around asking what would Walt think all the time, like people thought we did. So there isn't really a question I need to ask him, but I know with attention to detail and quality, and when you put a Disney name on something, what the product must have from in terms of its attributes. So I feel like basically channeling Walt through Michael, I learned a lot. Michael was good at that. In terms of how it's different, you know, the most interesting thing, maybe this is true for a lot of CEO jobs at big American or global companies these days, is the pull that you feel externally is much greater than I ever expected, meaning the amount of time I am asked to spend outside the company on other things is enormous, and I'm fighting that a lot. I think that I'll be better at my job, and I hope the company will be better if I spend much more time internally focused. And but that takes a lot of energy, and you say no an awful lot.
But do you mean like events where you represent Disney?
Speaking engagements, events, CEO gatherings. No, that's there are constituencies that I have to address. Investors, advertisers, distributors, the creative community, Washington, board members, press, and our cast members. And of all of them, we're spending more time on our cast than anything else. And it's really valuable. I guess that would be also, to answer your question, the amount of time I spend with people internally, much greater than I ever expected. Valuable. And my trip to Orlando was more designed for that. I met housekeeping at hotels. I went to the reservation center. I met Imagineering. I did 1,000-person meetings with people who were in our what I'll call a high-potential category. I shook hands at attractions with everyone. Just a lot of time there, generating an interest and an enthusiasm, belief in Disney, and also preaching the gospel these days, which is what direction we want to take the company.
I have fun. Yeah. First of all, I cry after I get on vacation, too. especially the last couple of years. But Time Warner made a comment that they are obviously looking to take some cable networks off their systems if they don't get the ratings as a function of trying to keep a lid on their programming expenses and that sort of thing. And I was just wondering if you thought the proliferation of cable networks has come pretty much to an end, and what your thoughts are on the prospects of either one launching new networks or buying additional networks in the future, and if you think that the economic model is still as attractive.
You have to start with a great idea and something you can brand. I really believe that in this world, specifically in the direction of cable networks, you have to earn your right into the consumer's homes or onto a platform. And that means you have to have a good proposition going in, and you have to be good once you launch. And in reality, marketplace conditions should dictate how much shelf space you get. It's one of the reasons why I believe in net neutrality, by the way. Turn your way onto a system or through a pipe. That shouldn't be mandated by the government, first of all. And while you use some different business leverage to get more shelf space, which is true in a lot of different businesses, in the end, if you're not earning it, meaning because you're in demand by a consumer or some other faction, then you should lose the access. That's simple. It's one of the reasons why we're trying to focus as much as we can on strengthening these things. So I think it's a less hospitable environment because you're not getting growth in the number of channels. People out there are not saying, oh, I got to have another channel. I don't have enough channels today. In fact, I think in general, you could conclude there might be too many. And so I take a conservative approach, as you can gather there. I'm not ruling out creating a new one if we feel that we've got a great idea. Now, just creating ESPN 5, I don't think so.
The Alt Show. ESPN, The Alt Show.
The Art Show?
The Alt Show.
Oh, Alt Show. Alt Show, that's right. Yeah. That was from Dodgeball.
Dodgeball.
Dodgeball. Ocho. If we have a good consumer proposition, then we'll be able to sell it to distributors, and we should get space. If we don't, we shouldn't launch. And branding is really valuable. The lesson we learned the hard way, in a way, was with ABC Family. And it's doing quite well now. Their programming is strong. Their ratings are good. But I think you have to stand for something in that world, because the choice is just so great. Okay. Thank you. Oh, nice to see you.
Thank you.
Enjoy Jimmy Kimmel tonight?
Yep.
Do you have any guests that are worth anything? Or?
Chris Matthews.
That's interesting. You're not going to dance or sing, but...
Okay. No, we'll do that. We'll do that.
Andy's had a good day because our brand new Russian country manager has been with us for the day. So we're getting a good education in Russia. So with that, we're not going to go imagine we're three in St. Petersburg in January.
We're going to go in June.
What is that?
June. We'll see the White Knights.
So we have to think of that, isn't it?
Exactly. Her name's Marina, and she's spending a week with us now. Go on, Wendy, do you need to introduce me?
We're joined by Andy Bird at this point, head of our Welcome to the International. And I don't know if you want to start with anything, Andy, or just launch right into taking folks' questions if you have a overarching strategy, vision, what you're trying to achieve around the world.
I have nothing prepared, but, I mean, you know, hopefully talking to Bob, technology, creativity, and international, three pillars of the growth strategy of the company. And really, one of the things, you know, last year we did around about $7 billion of revenue, 22%, 25% operating income coming through our international markets. We see a great deal of potential as the world gets more sophisticated in terms of both infrastructure, technology, economies, and we believe as the world also gets more fragmented in terms of media choices available to people, brands and well-established brands, particularly in the media space, are going to come that more important and a lot more relevant. And so we feel we're in a pretty good place to go take advantage of that in the international marketplace. And one of my roles is, you know, working with Bob is to interface with all of the lines of business to ensure that we grow as a company on an enterprise-wide basis on a country-by-country basis. And I often say when I address people, hands up, how many of you have been on vacation to international? And you're all far, far too smart to put your hands up because you cannot go on vacation to international. And one of the big things, because you don't go to LAX or an airport and get on a plane that goes to international, you go to countries. And very much what we're doing within the Walt Disney Company is change the perception of, you know, it's the US and international. And in so many countries, companies, decision making and just the general thought process of how you go about your day-to-day business is to think about the United States and international. This is an amorphous blend of those hundreds of other, you know, 200 plus countries out there. We're a global brand and we want to behave and act as a global company, and we're very much positioning ourselves, and I'm happy to talk in generalized specifics in terms of some of our strategies as we move forward, but I'd just say because we think in terms of individual countries rather than one amorphous group of international and the US, we have roughly three different bands or categories in terms of how we look at the world outside the United States, and we've grouped those into the emerging markets, developing markets, and then more developed markets, and we really have different strategies in place by country but also by those sort of three broad segments. And broadly speaking, what you're seeing us do in the emerging markets, you know, the appointment of Marina and the opening up and increase of our presence in Russia is a very, very good example of that, is we're in the China, India, Russia, very much of what we're doing today is positioning and building shelf space for the future. And the future is 5 to 10 years down the road. And so the opportunities and a lot of what we're doing in those markets today is very much about positioning ourselves to really capitalize as those markets grow up and develop. As we say, more in the 5 to 10 year time horizon. The way the analogy I use is, a good surfer. I live out near Malibu, in your neck of the woods, and go down there. You watch the surface, and a lot of it's positioning yourself on the seat for when the wave comes in, so you can ride that break all the way into the shore. And so what we're doing in those markets is a lot of positioning ourselves, our brands, our franchises, our characters in those marketplaces. And the wave in the emerging markets is the wave of the rising economy, technology, and infrastructure. Those are the three main elements that are going to really rapidly grow, that's then going to drive the growth of the company in those market spaces. So building shelf space, getting our brands established in emerging markets is very, very important to us. And the other thing I would say,
I'm sorry, what is the biggest hurdle in trying to break into these emerging markets? Is it the fact that the infrastructure is taking so long to be built, the fact that discretionary income is not quite there, or what do you find as being the biggest hurdle in the emerging market?
There is no one answer, unfortunately. I mean, that's a great challenge for us and the great opportunity for us, is there is no one answer. There are different things. Regulation in certain sectors, for example, in China, is a lot different to the infrastructure issues that you have in India. And in fact, one of the advantages I think we have, though, as a company, certainly as opposed to other media companies, and it often gets written about because the media, there's a lot of focus on television. And, I was reading some piece the other week about ourselves and China. Someone wrote, they've got to get a television channel in there. Well, actually, we don't necessarily. Our consumer products business, which is a very, very large business for us in China and is the focus of our strategy in China, is something that other media companies just don't have in the same scale or size. And so we're growing up to 6,000 Disney Corners in China. We have over 3,000 Disney Corners at retail now. We have really strong presence in all the mass marketeers go in, the Walmarts, the Carrefours, the Auchans of the world, Tesco's of the world go into the China and start developing 50, 60 stores each. We are riding that wave as they expand through China. The television aspect, we are able through CCTV 14 and Dragon Club and other things to get exposure for our characters. Would we like more? Yes, of course, but unlike some other media companies, it's not the be and the end all of our business and a measure of our success in that market per se. And I think one of the great advantages that we have is twofold. One, we have a diversified portfolio of assets, so we can change our asset mix by country by country. So contrast what I've just said about China with India, where there's no foreign direct investment currently allowed in the retail space. Retail is very, very fragmented. And so actually there, the lead sort of business for us in the Indian market is television, and is television networks, and we have Disney Channel, and soon Disney has two 24-hour networks that have been in there about 18 months now, which is building up presence so that when retail comes in, we're able to capitalize on that piece of the business. We're also moving both China and India heavily in the internet space and the mobile space. We did Disney-branded mobile phones in China, which were a huge success. Announced we're going to be doing some more of those, and these are handsets that have come. The beauty of the Disney franchise and the Disney characters in the Asian region is they have a huge appeal up to a much higher demographic, particularly amongst women. You go to the park in Japan, there's this great phenomenon of office ladies, sort of 16, 18 year olds up to 25 year olds. really core Disney fans. And it becomes very, very iconic, both in terms of apparel, but also in terms of, everyone wears their cell phones, so we produced it for China, Disney-branded, character-branded phones. They come embedded with Disney content. So, you've already got, a lot of rich media embedded into these systems. We were able to approach a market and look at a whole different array of assets than the traditional, well, we've got to go purely down the television route, one way or the other. So I think, there's not a simple answer. Then infrastructure comes along, and then you want to see, how disposable income and all those other factors start to take place. So I either have some questions, or I can talk about anything and all that.
A question earlier on, I'd like to ask it again, just to get your viewpoint on it. How America is viewed in the world has maybe changed in the last 5 or 6 years. Do you see that at all in your business, or is that just sort of the way media is portraying?
Relative to the Disney product? In other words, you're asking how's America?
Relative to the, if you know in a broad sense, but specifically relative to the Disney.
And which part of the world you're standing in when you're
there,
look at it.
Is there an issue with someone wearing
it's a very good question, and it's something we spend a lot of time, not just today, but have always spent, one of the great advantages we have is we put our name above the door, go out and recognition of whether it's Mickey Mouse or the Disney name, you can be in the middle of nowhere and I can pull my business card out pretty much anywhere in the world and people know who we are. That is a fantastic asset for us to have, but it's something that we've got to treasure and nurture very, very carefully. So we do spend a lot of time and making sure that there's no overtone one way or the other. We're very, very fortunate as a company that he was a very international person, he traveled a lot. He also localized a lot. And from a very, very early stage, we've localized our product. Mickey Mouse is Topolino in Italy. He's not Mickey Mouse, he's always been Topolino. He's Nilao Shu in China. He's Mickey Mouse, M-A-U-S, in Germany, for example. From the day one, that's how he's been. So the people, I was talking to someone about the Nissan Z350 or whatever in the US. Everyone goes, well, that's a Nissan. But I think that car only exists in the US. I know the Nissan Micra in the UK. And for me, that is a Nissan. The fact is they only make it in the UK. So we've been very, very fortunate at localizing ourselves so we get a very local feel. So it's a long way of saying we've never really been perceived as an American brand. It's as much as America as Hollywood. A Hollywood movie is more of a state of mind than necessarily a place just around the corner, and it's very important that we maintain that, and we take a lot of effort to ensure it's not just about localizing products and putting in local language. It's actually about adapting local products to local cultures and local franchises and all the different things we do, so that Disney becomes completely relevant to the community and the culture that we're dealing with. So you're seeing in those efforts, in the studio, Dick was talking to you earlier. I don't know if he talked to you about The Secret of the Magic Gourd.
No.
The Secret of the Magic Gourd is our first Chinese language movie we're making, which is being made just for China and Chinese-speaking territories. Now, if it's successful, we may then export it around the world from China. But it's a different mindset of away from getting from this US versus international. We can make Disney product that's going to work in a particular market. We've done, we have two film labels in Latin America, Patagonic and Mira Vista, that produces movies that are produced for that marketplace alone. We've had success co-producing and co-financing and acquiring movies in Europe. Calendar Girls in the UK was a more recent example of a movie we've done there. Kinky Boots is currently playing now, which is a UK title we picked up.
Yeah, periodically, the media has criticized Hong Kong Disneyland for being for not catering enough to the Chinese market. Again, it's other media. Maybe they're jealous. I don't know, but.
I don't think they're jealous. I don't know, not for me to comment what their motives are. All I can say is that Hong Kong Disneyland has the highest appreciation, customer guest appreciation, of any park we have in the world. And you go, it's different. You see, the culturally, it's a lot different. One of the most popular attractions at Hong Kong Disneyland is an area that's been developed specifically so you can have your photograph taken with characters. The whole Fantasy Gardens section. Because they've never been able to do that. I saw a family fly down from Shanghai, family of four, come out and once they'd filled their memory card up with photos, that was it. For them, the experience of being able to stand in a main street and the experience to be able to interact with characters and just they've never ever seen anything like this. So the one thing I always say is try not to look at everything through either Western eyes or a particular set of ideals or parameters, because conditions are completely different, in China or in India or in Brazil, completely different. So the most important thing is the people who walk through the front gate to Hong Kong Disneyland have a fantastic time and we get high satisfaction, results coming back from our research. And that's what's happening, and we're well on track to do exactly what we wanted to do in terms of attendance and everything like that. People saying, oh well, it's not this, it's not that, it's not the other. Well, frankly, we're building something that's right for that market, not right for how people perceive something as it opposed to compared to Anaheim or Orlando or something else. It's very, very important to think of the perspective from which our products are being viewed, whether that's a theme park or a DVD or a television series.
I found it interesting when in Hong Kong that more of the people there actually went to the shows than some of the rides. And I wonder if your thoughts are on how you can expand the park a little bit. What are you thinking about, putting in more venues, more theatrical venues, or have you?
We've announced that we're opening Autopia this summer in Hong Kong Disneyland. I'm not sure what else we've announced there. Another little attraction in Tomorrowland. The short answer is the shows, again, the immersive experience that a Disneyland provides is a completely unique and brand new concept to anyone in from that part of the world. They have never ever seen that. They've been to a theme park which is a bunch of iron rides on a bit of flat ground, and that's it. So the concept, that's what I'm saying, the concept is to walk through these gates into a world and suddenly go Main Street. Things that we get, somewhat jaded because you see Main Street USA and every time you go to Disneyland or Orlando or something like that, why the hell would that be special? Once you're there, you see, if you saw on the opening nights of the fireworks, and you look back down Main Street and all you could see was thousands, 10,000, thousands of camera phones just going like this, click, click, click. But that's all you could do, it's an abiding memory. If you stand by the castle and you look down Main Street at night and you just see all these people, because they have never ever experienced anything like that. And it's the people talk about immersive marketing. That is the purest form of immersive marketing in terms of the brand and characters and franchise you could get. Does that answer?
Absolutely.
Something I don't understand. The international parks, I think, are break even from a profit standpoint. Is that right? But from a cash flow standpoint, I'm not actually quite sure what the situation is. And so if you could explain that to me.
We're only partial owners or zero owners in parks, depending on which park it is. So Tokyo, for example, we don't own anything, and we get royalties every year from that, a percentage off the top, off the revenues. The other parks, we also have the same royalty arrangement in Paris and in Hong Kong, where we have 51% ownership in Paris and 43% in Hong Kong. We have some book accounting entries that have to do with consolidation of those parks, but that's simply on a book. In cash flow sensitive, in your earlier questions about parks, these are net cash contributors given the cash accounting based on the royalty payments.
Okay. So they're not really, let's say, loss leaders in a sense to really kind of drive the Disney brand outside of the U.S.
No.
It's something where you're looking to not only drive the brand, but also to make money.
Right, and after-tax cash return on invested capital, which is our method of assessing investment decisions, is very positive, given the minority or lack of capital expense.
You know, the way to think about companies, goes back to this, think of a mosaic. Each country that we operate in is a mosaic of assets, a collage of different assets we have. And you think of everything from the publishing business to the internet groups, or radio assets, Radio Disney down in Latin America and Argentina. It's a really, really important driver of our brands and things that, people don't automatically think of the Walt Disney Company when you sit around and you're analyzing, because again, you tend to think of all the asset base and how it's measured on in the U.S., but as we go country by country, the great beauty of our company is that we're able to take all of these different assets and really start to, play one off, not play one off against the other, but leverage one against the other and make sure that one's supporting, what are some of the key driver businesses for us. And obviously, whenever you have something that's fantastic as a theme park, it's the brand halo that it, those, and the other thing that internationally has a disproportionate impact on the brand is our live shows. Live entertainment, whether through the park experience or going to see Lion King, we're putting Lion King on in Shanghai, opening up in July, which would be, to take that Broadway show and put that into the ripple effect is so much greater, the brand halo effect is so much greater than the physical number of people who will walk through and see those performances in the theatre. And we see that, that's why we have a number of these shows, plus we have the Disney on Ice shows and a couple of touring shows and different things around. It's very interesting. And I think sometimes people underestimate the breadth and the depth of the Disney presence in international markets, both just in terms of generally how many countries we're doing significant business in, but also much more than that, the actual depth of the presence there is quite phenomenal. 12 million magazines sold in China, 3 million books with people don't even think about, that's part of our business in certain parts of the world.
Do you think that demographics overseas are perhaps your largest structural advantage, like Asia or Latin America with very young populations?
Yeah. Plus, I think that there's a just technologically wise. It's not very good English, is it? A lot more people are becoming enabled through technology to be aware of our brands and aware of our characters, whether that's through the rolling out of television infrastructure in markets, or whether that's the rollout of the internet or mobile phones. What I find very, very interesting, particularly in emerging markets, is how technology has leapfrogged because there's no legacy issues. And so that wave I mentioned earlier, when they come in, it's the latest fiber cable, that they get, high-speed broadband, the latest super slim, does everything, makes a cup of coffee, mobile phone, which is, 2-3 years ahead of the technology that's here in the US. And so, we can see the ways that for people, both the demographically but also use technology, the way that they're able to sample and enjoy our products, I think it's going to, when you then have a recognizable characters and brands, when you have a recognizable brand like the Walt Disney Company, or Disney, that places us in a good place, I think. You should be able to capitalize on that.
I think you said you have about $1.1 billion in international profit. Did I understand that correctly?
I don't think I said that.
25% of the total?
Yeah.
Okay. So, can you walk us through the split amongst your divisions today of that profit pie roughly, and how you see that differing 5 years from now, which is a way of sort of asking, which properties internationally or which segments are really going to fuel sort of the growth?
Yeah, fuel the growth. Do we break it down? I don't know if we've ever broken it down via. We haven't done it by business segment.
I think we have, though, said that our consumer products business is probably the most international in its own segment mix. By contrast, that's more than half of
the total company split.
Right. So
consumer products
has more than half of its operating income from outside the United
within
States.
Within consumer products.
In consumer products.
But we haven't really ever split out how those revenues are split via
for the company
as a whole.
And then media networks, just by virtue of owning television stations, still owning radio stations, a big ABC US-centric broadcast network, that tends to skew more heavily domestic than international.
But I can talk broadly in terms of drivers for the business going forward. You're going to see, as you see the increase in the proliferation of and the consolidation of retail, every time, as I was saying before, a Walmart or a Carrefour or Tesco or whatever opens a new store in a new market, whether it's in Central Eastern Europe or when they eventually get allowed into India or as they're doing in China, that's going to provide opportunity for us. Technology, which includes multi-channel television, there's still a lot of upside of growth internationally in that area. The broadband space and the mobile space is a big area for us, and also the studio, the international already is a significant piece of the studio's business, and with the increase of multiplex and the opportunities of more pay TV platforms, there's an awful lot of growth. There's not one sort of killer app. There's not one single thing. If you think of that wave of infrastructure, technology, and general disposal, the economy, GDP growing in a lot of these markets, and we're not, the UK, developed markets like UK and Japan, there's still an enormous amount of growth left in those markets. We launched 15 months ago, ABC One on the DTT on the Freeview platform, which has just exploded. Digital terrestrial television, and that's just exploded, and it has given us a great basis to now we put Playhouse Disney block on that, so it's going to help drive our DCP business and some of our key franchises and things like that. 2 years ago, that didn't even exist. So I think, without being too general, but I am, it's, there's an enormous amount of opportunity because the world, is developed. There's an awful lot of development left in the spaces we work.
What does Pixar do for you?
Pixar does as much for us internationally as it does for the company as a whole. It's a great brand. It produces great product for us. It enables us, I think, creatively. There was an exhibition over in New York, a Pixar exhibition. That's actually it's traveling to Tokyo. Opens in June in Tokyo. There's been a great deal of just the appeal of the Pixar films and the Pixar brand itself internationally is as strong, and there's some markets stronger than you see here in the U.S. And so for all the reasons, I don't know, did Dick talk to you earlier about for all of those reasons, they are completely applicable in international markets. You know, it's a fantastic addition for the company to have on a whole host of different levels. Doesn't really answer your question, does it? Well, what do you want?
I guess I'm still trying to figure out, like, what can you do differently in the future now that Disney will own Pixar than maybe you've been able to do in the past? And is it really a significant change in what you see the company doing, whether that's more integration with parks or just more control of the characters? Or
I think one of the things is, you know, we're a company, and I've mentioned before, you know, we're very good at developing franchises. And one of the things it's going to enable us to do is develop franchises in a more cohesive manner and at a quicker pace, so that when you go to talk to key retailers, whether it's cars or whether it's a Toy Story or a Finding Nemo, the change from events, oh, that was good, that's a great movie, and then it sort of disappears off into the ether in terms of, well, actually, that's part of a process of building a series of franchises. As you roll that out on an international basis, country by country, that gains a great deal of traction. The ability of the coming, and John's talked about this at the shareholders meeting, you know, as we start to plan movies, to start planning theme park attractions around those movies at the same time, because these movies develop and they take 2-3 years to produce, you know, at the same time concurrently you're producing a theme park attraction that can open almost concurrently with the hype and the buzz of a movie, is going to be a huge, enormous potential for, you know, upside. You know, you'd be able to put that into Tokyo, into Hong Kong, into Paris, to Anaheim, Orlando at the same time. It's a huge, huge uplift to the company. And I think also, you know, the benefit it will give to Disney's feature animation units as well. Now, I'm talking more generally, not specifically internationally. I think if you're surrounded and you have that much talent at your disposal and creativity, technology, international, you have that so much creative expertise available within the company, can only be a good thing. Help a little bit?
Yeah.
In terms of something really obvious that I should be doing this.
No, no, no. It's a good driver of success.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
A really quick drive is opening a theme park in Hong Kong. Something like that, because you're going to get huge scale and boom.
Will you say hi?
Maybe.
Well, you mentioned Russia, China, India, all those three countries. Where do you think you're going to be the most profitable, most sales?
All three. But at differing times. I think, actually, I believe Russia will give us more short-term uplift, and maybe in case of low-hanging fruit, maybe in terms of the market. That's really interesting, because the explosion in, there's been this whole growth of Russian middle class that's just, I don't know how many of you have been to Moscow recently or ever. It's really, really interesting. Yeah, in my good old days, I went touring there with a band in the 1980s, and you stood in the Goom store, and there was nothing on the shelves. And you go there now, and it's Prada, Louis Vuitton, Gucci. You walk around the corner to the Ferrari store. It's, you know, those
are those catering to Russians or tourists?
No, that's to Russians. I think there's a $21 billion middle class that has emerged in the last few years. You go to Cannes in the south of France, and you go to the restaurants, the menus are in English, French, and Russian. So there's a huge, huge middle class that has grown up, and they are very, very brand-centric. You see this again in Asia, and they want authenticity. There's a great joke of Russian women talking to each other, and one says, I went all the way to, look at my new bag, I went all the way to Paris and paid $3,000 for this bag, Louis Vuitton or whatever it is, and the colleague says, well, why did you do that when you could have spent $4,000 and bought it here in Moscow? Mm-hmm. You know, it's all about, you know, you could, it's, there's the very, you know, the desire for brands and the desire for, you know, luxury goods, but the branded goods of all sizes is really, really growing at an unprecedented rate in Russia. It's already a really big market for us in for our studio business. It's in top 10 market for us from a theatrical point of view. So I think in the medium term, I think Russia may be a country that we haven't talked that much about, and that may surprise some people. I'm saying that because I'm flush with the optimism of hiring Marina. No. I mean, there is a reason why we hired Marina, and that's one of the reasons we do feel optimistic about that country. China, we do great there already, and a lot of people underestimate how well we do in that marketplace because they just tend to focus on one thing and they don't look at the retail presence we have and the breadth of our presence in any great detail in that marketplace. And as that country continues to grow, we feel pretty well positioned, not complacent, but pretty well positioned in that marketplace. India is a land of opportunity. Foreign direct investment in the retail sector has to come along at some point. In the very, very near future, there's been some recent legislation that seems that's going to occur. And the general infrastructure in India, as that starts to grow, that can be only good news for us. So I would not want to rank, because I would rank them in the wrong order. Whichever order I said, I would be wrong. Mm-hmm. But broadly speaking, I think Russia will surprise us. China will continue to do very well for us. And India will grow exponentially outside of... It's really, at the moment, still a media business. It's very, very media-centric. It's as India moves into some of these other areas, it becomes a lot more interesting for a company such as ourselves.
Are you happy with your partners there? I mean, in terms of your working with Star?
Yeah, Star. We actually do have a partnership, which often people overlook. Again, you know, along with Star, we are 50-50 co-owners of ESS, ESPN Star Sports, which is the largest sports provider in the region. And that's not a partnership where, you know, the 50% is we own ESPN and they own Star. We own 50% of everything and they own 50% of everything. And, you know, it's hugely strong in India, throughout the rest of Europe, throughout the rest of Asia. China, you know, has a very, very good presence. We have ESPN, the magazine in China. Not a lot of people knew that. The relationship starts very, very good, and then we have a distribution relationship with the Star platform in India for the two Disney Channel and Disney. Yeah, as they are in the rest of the world, and very, very good operators.
What country products that you currently don't have do you most covet?
Not sure I understand.
Well, where are you with what products do you wish you were most? New practice India, retail, maybe China TV.
Retail in India would be nice. More television in somewhere like China would be nice. More local. I think what we've got to do generally is look at more localized content to supplement the content that is originated in the US. That's something that I mentioned, the movie we're making in China. That's just one example. We have a fantastic, in our publishing division, we have called Academia. We have a fantastic creative center in Milan. We produced some brilliant stuff for our publishing world, and out of that came a franchise called Which, which has grown into a huge publishing franchise, now television consumer products franchise. We've got a couple of other ideas around that, looking at, you know, how we create more localized IP platform, develop ideas to really, you know, we have a fantastic infrastructure. We have a very deep presence in a lot of markets around the world. So how we're able to capitalize on that, I think, is going to be, you know, key to us.
Maybe one last question over here.
Could you talk a little bit about the dynamic of, using Hong Kong as a proxy when you're approaching a project? Do you see more push from the government, as in, you know, if they want more ownership than you're willing to give them? I mean, you know, basically what you guys look at in regards to your return on capital and how much you'd let the, you know, the government get involved, and what do you think they use as a proxy of how much they want to get involved?
Specifically, referring to theme parks. I don't think Jay could answer it better than myself. We don't generally have a set point of view on an ideal formula one way or the other. We like the structure we have in Hong Kong, but similarly, you know, we have a completely different structure in Tokyo, as Wendy was saying earlier. Slightly different structure in Paris. You know, the key is having the flexibility to create the right organization and operation and financial structure to suit that particular set of conditions in that particular marketplace. That, more than anything, is the most important thing, rather than saying, you know what, we want to do this with, you know, we only would ever consider this type of capital structure, or we would only ever consider this type of, you know, organizational structure. That's overriding, rather than, you know, there are many, we're very fortunate, there are many places in the world that would like to entertain, you know, some sort of theme park. So we've got to be very, you know, diligent in terms of how we proceed on those lines.
Who would we compete with? Anyone gigantic, multinational, or is each local target of its own competition?
We compete with, I think, I don't think there's one competitor. I think there's numerous competitors, and I don't think they're all media competitors. We compete with a share of individuals' time and pocketbook in terms of how they spend their leisure time. I think that would be the best way of describing that. So we're competing with magazine companies in terms of, or book publishing companies, or radio stations, or television channels, or other theme park attractions, or retail. You know, we actually compete in so many different spaces that I don't think there is one. And I actually think, again, because I think it makes us kind of unique in terms of, you know, the branded leisure entertainment space. I don't think there is one particular segment or sector or media company or consumer goods company that we could say we're directly, you know, comparable with. We have a great deal of breadth and a great deal of depth, and I think that stands us in very, very good stead, because in some markets, as you just look at China and India, you know, the skew is so different that it's difficult to say we're one thing or the other.
How do you think your growth rate is going to compare to the overall company over the next 3 to 5 years?
I would personally hope that we are going to probably grow on a percentage basis at a faster rate than the overall company. I would expect us to do that. But at the same time, I think we can do some very interesting things here in the US as well, and that's always very, very good. You know, it's a double-edged sword, which is why when you say, so what percentage do you think you would actually have of international, you know, it depends, you know, we'd actually would be very happy to stay at the same relative percentages if the U.S. was growing at a fantastic rate. So we're not as concerned. What does concern us is that we do two things. One is we do grow, good double-digit growth in terms of these key markets. And at the same time that we're really positioning ourselves, it's not all about making money today in some of these markets. A lot of it's about, strategically placing yourself to capitalize on what could be the opportunities down the road. So taking a much more sort of medium-term, long-term view in terms of how these markets are going to grow up. Some of these countries have been around thousands and thousands of years. So take a bit of a longer-term view than sometimes many people are used to.
Thank you very much, Andy.
Thank you for your time. Enjoy your afternoon. Your evening and everything else.
Thank you.
I'll go and see one of the readers, though.
Yes, thank you very much. That concludes our webcast.